said. How could one formulate such an insight in a language that is not misunderstood in our days? Then, explaining why it is not possible to discuss alcohol without recognizing its relationship to humans' subconscious desire for spiritual harmony, he concluded, Alcohol in Latin is spiritus, and you use the same word for the highest religious experience as well as for the most depraved poison. I remain yours sincerely, C. G. Jung. Of course, the old Latin usage is retained to this day by calling strong alcohol spirits. Beyond the compelling call of addiction, I don't think that anyone deliberately absorbs mind-changing drugs into his or her system for anything other than to quiet a gnawing spiritual dissatisfaction with life. It would certainly seem odd that the first U.S. generation to have been raised with almost limitless material possession was the generation to have turned for relief to a substance that up till then was usually found in the sordid waterfront dives of the downtrodden. By its notable naming of the generations, the Bible identifies a common and recurring trend. Generations raised with very little in the way of material possession often focus so single-mindedly on providing their children with everything they didn't have that they neglect to provide their children with some of the things they did have. Through this invisible mechanism, the generation of material acquisitiveness often gives way to the generation of spiritual searching. Unfortunately, this spiritual searching is not in itself valuable, and it often leads to a widespread cultural decline reflected in the Bible's name for the successive generation, Jared. A period of cultural decline. This can hardly be considered a comprehensive sociological analysis, and I do not intend to dismiss a complex field of study with a couple of sentences. But certain forms of cultural decline could certainly be identified between the hippie period and the end of the 20th century. Whether it was the rising crime figures during this period, or the dramatic increase in children born to unmarried mothers, something disturbing was happening, and it would have been hard to characterize it at all as anything but cultural decline. The period was marked by lengthy lines at gas stations and by double-digit interest rates, and it was marked by an increase in public vulgarity. Although many sectors of the economy were thriving, the culture as an essential part of the civilization was not. In general, one can always count on the three epochs of materialism, spiritual quest, and cultural decline to follow one another. Beyond that, there are always patterns and trends to watch and to try to understand. As business professionals, you should remain on high alert for these trends, and you should try to understand the underlying causes driving them. How to use the cycles of life to determine other trends. During the 1920s, a Russian economist called Nicholas Kondratiev studied the economic, cultural, and social life of the 19th century and concluded that the biblical rule of the 50-year cycle did indeed hold up. This biblically identified cycle occurs naturally within any reasonably free society and is called Yobel. There is a well-known J/Y transliteration revealed by the English translation of the Hebrew name of the prophet and reluctant sailor who got swallowed by the whale, Jonah. With the same J/Y shift that made Jonah into Jonah, Yobel became Jubilee in English, the word for a 50-year celebration of any major event. Kondratiev noticed a 50-year pattern to everything, even war, that is even clearer today. Although it is obviously far from mathematically precise, the approximate periodicity was nonetheless eye-catching to Kondratiev and to his later devotees. Many amateur historians are entranced by the apparent tendency for wars to be fought approximately every 25 years, with a longer superimposed 50-year cycle of popular versus unpopular wars. I am using the terms popular and unpopular to describe popular sentiment about the war in question. These sentiments are usually retrospective, so that a popular war is one seen to have had a popular outcome and about which people tend to look back with some degree of nostalgia. For example, consider these wars over the past 150 years. 1990. Popular. Gulf War. 1965. Unpopular. Vietnam War. 1940. Popular. World War II. 1915. Unpopular. World War I. 1890. Popular. Spanish-American War. Open parenthesis, actually 1898. However, the first Pan-American Conference was held in October 1889 that laid out U.S. commercial interests in Latin America that were later threatened in Cuba by Spain. Close parenthesis. 1865, unpopular, Civil War. Students of international political economy are interested in the relationship between various wars and what they called the Kondratiev wave. Although Joseph Schumpeter endorsed the concept during the 1930s, many scholars are profoundly disturbed by the implication that, among human beings, there may be an inexorable inevitability about war. Needless to say, the Kondratiev wave theory, like many other wave theories, is considered quite controversial. Although much less disturbing than war itself, the apparent inevitability to economic cycles is no less interesting. Again, although it is not mathematically exact to the year, there does indeed appear to be some reliable correlation from 1800 to 2000 between U.S. wholesale prices and an idealized perfect 50-year Kondratiev wave. Eras of great economic growth also appear to be separated by either 25 or 50 years, depending on what you examine. For instance, these are the approximate years in which various scientific and industrial developments entered popular usage and began contributing to wealth creation. 2000, Internet. 1975, computers. 1950, plastics. 1925, broadcasting. 1900, auto industry. 1875, telephone. 1850, telegraph. Many people find the notion of regular cycles appearing to govern human affairs to be eerie, even sinister. Unfortunately for Nicholas Kondratiev, his boss, Joseph Stalin, was one of those who did not much appreciate the idea that a 3,000-year-old Bible contains an insight that might help explain the economic development of enlightened Russians. In 1938, he executed Kondratiev, but the Kondratiev wave continues to entrance generations of observers. You may find yourself intrigued by the Kondratiev wave or by other similar wave theories. Alternately, you might find yourself repulsed by them. As a business professional, you should embrace neither extreme. No wave theory is a brilliant beam of light illuminating both past and future of all there is to know. However, neither ought you to entirely discredit the notion of cycles and periods in human affairs. They are present, and do play something of a role. For example, Consider these patterns. The Earth rotates on its axis approximately once every 24 hours, causing the sun to appear fairly predictably on the eastern horizon every morning. The moon revolves around the Earth roughly every 29 and a half days, and the Earth revolves around the sun about once in every 365 and a quarter days. Once every 28 years, the sun and the moon return to the same points relative to one another. Once every 93,408 years, the entire solar system completes one full cycle with all the planets in the same relative configuration. Ocean tides rise and fall about once every 12 and a half hours. Weather cycles are influenced by longer-term solar and lunar cycles. The sun's temperature rises and falls every 11 years, as does its electromagnetic activity as indicated by sunspots. The moon's gravity seems to vary on an 18.6-year cycle, and the Earth's temperature and pressure averages seem to vary according to a 20-year cycle. Finally, consider these patterns in nature. Every 3.86 years, Norwegian lemmings leap from cliffs into the sea below. Every 9.7 months, on Ascension Island in the South Atlantic, terns swarm in to hatch their eggs. In Canada, the lynx population has risen and fallen regularly every 9.6 years since at least 1735, when records began to be kept. Some of these things are known because of the work of Edward Dewey, an economist at the U.S. Department of Commerce during the 1920s and 1930s. Intrigued by the obvious cycles in business, banking, labor, and the production of goods, he assembled an enormous collection of more than 3,000 documented cycles and the associated data. There are cycles in water levels in U.S. lakes, in number of U.S. marriages, in the abundance of grasshoppers, 9.2 years in case you wanted to know, and in the rate of residential home construction. There are well-established cycles for industrial bond yields, auto sales, and cheese consumption. The periodicity of aluminum production, airplane traffic, and mental health are fact. No one really knows whether any of these cycles are related to one another. It seems bizarre to think of a link between grasshopper fecundity and sales figures at the Fortune 500 companies. However, from the point of view of a statistician, it is out of the question to explain this all by coincidence. The correspondence of similar cycles is far too pervasive to be explained by mere chance. Therefore, you should be open to the possibility of cycles and trends, but you should never allow yourself to become blinded by them. They should be a factor in your assessment of what the future will bring, but only one factor, and they should be given appropriate weight, neither too low nor too high. Perhaps you are considering buying a rental property, investing in a preschool program for working mothers, or simply trying to select a good stock in which to invest. In each of these cases, the wise course of action would be to try to see the future. Part of developing an effective understanding of how the world really works includes accustoming yourself to analyzing cause and effect. With a little concentration, it eventually becomes a useful habit. Few events are totally isolated. Instead, you ought to try to see events as links in a chain. Even modern meteorology depends on analysts wondering how the distant hurricane will affect local weather. The person who habitually asks, "What caused this thing to happen?" and then asks, "What in turn will be caused by this thing?" is well on the way to becoming a wise person. Smart investors do this each time they open their morning paper or watch the television news programs. What's that? A pipeline explosion in some far-off place? Could that cause a shortage of whatever commodity was being piped? A new type of miniaturized liquid crystal display with built-in magnification was just invented. Now, who could benefit from a product that is ideal for workers requiring access to a computer while also operating other machinery? A new president who is more favorably disposed to the military than his outgoing predecessor might be interested in increasing military spending, some of which would benefit those companies making the kind of weaponry that a modern army needs. Is my town growing? What is causing the growth? And in which direction is it growing? Should I perhaps buy some property in the part of town into which people seem to be moving? In each case, information is already available. Jewish culture calls this the laid egg. How and when that egg will hatch, and what sort of creature will crawl out of it, is up to you to determine. That is why learning to think in terms of understanding the future is so important. Consecrating time for forecasting. Have you ever lain awake late at night and just listened to the sounds in your home? You will hear slight creaking sounds as beams, roofs, or even window frames expand or contract with changing temperatures. You may hear the whistle of a distant locomotive or tugboat. If you listen carefully, you will hear the refrigerator in your kitchen cycling on and off. Now, when did you last hear your refrigerator cycling during the daytime? It does so during daylight, just as it surely does at night. Did you ever hear your home's creaking sounds during the day? You seldom hear them, yet all those noises are taking place then, too. My point is that when your sensory input mechanisms, that is, your eyes and ears, are being bombarded with a large number of powerful stimuli, you become less sensitive to the soft, subtle sounds and sights. You may marvel at the almost imperceptible scent worn by the woman with whom you are dining, or at the fragrance from the flowers on the table in the restaurant. Now, walk into the restaurant's smelly kitchen with your companion while carrying those flowers, and I can assure you that you will smell nothing but the odor from the chef's deep fryer in the corner. Coming events do indeed send soft and subtle signals. The reason almost everyone disregards them is that few set aside the necessary quiet time to take note of them. If it is truly important to you to hear your refrigerator cycle on and off, then you must send the party revelers home and turn off the radio and television. Block out all the noise, and then you will clearly hear the almost silent compressor motor turning on and off. If it is truly important to you to hear the soft footsteps of approaching trends, then you have to do the same thing. You need to set aside time when other more compelling stimuli are absent. Only then will you be accessible to these tiny signals. One person who capitalized on his observation of trends was an entrepreneur named Morris Shepherd. He was a high school dropout from rural Ohio who joined the Air Force, where he discovered a love and a knack for cryptography. He finally earned a university degree and became a teacher at a succession of colleges. He taught at Penn State, Northeastern, Bridgewater, and other schools. Morris loved the classroom, but he wasn't too skilled at the political games played for promotion and tenure in the academic community. He was adored by his students, for whom he enhanced the courses with his boxes filled with news clippings, articles, and stories he collected. Whenever he changed jobs, he would lug along his file folders and crates of material with which he supplemented what he felt were the highly inadequate textbooks foisted upon his students. He was 58 years old and without a job in 1995, as he sadly contemplated his future of moving from one short-lived teaching assignment to another. One summer morning, he sat himself down under a shady tree for some quiet, dedicated thinking time. Away from all distractions, he paged idly through a copy of the New York Times. In the business section, he saw a description of a new Xerox copier capable of churning out short runs of entire books. Because he was not inundated with noise and interference, the future became clear to him. He saw textbooks becoming more expensive. He saw college bookstores becoming less competent at getting students their books before the opening of class. He saw emerging technology allowing him to create custom books for specific classes. He saw that his background was far more suited to creating these specialized teaching materials than it was to actual teaching. So, Shepard mortgaged his home, sucked his credit cards dry, and purchased the necessary photocopying equipment. Establishing relationships with professors at various colleges and universities, Morris Shepard was in business. He obtained copyright permission for each component and printed bound volumes containing all the collateral materials that each professor required for his course. Within 3 years, he had produced more than 2,500 course packs, as he calls them, and his business had grown to 38 employees. No longer does he have to endure the stuffy academic environment he detested, and no longer does he have to endure the employment uncertainty of the teaching profession. Shepard peered into the future, and because he did so in circumstances that allowed the soft signals to reach him, he saw it clearly, acted, and prospered. Almost anyone can use the model for seeing the future that is rooted in Jewish tradition. This model is based on the fourth of the Ten Commandments, observing the Sabbath day. Although many view the Sabbath as appearing to be governed by an incongruously primitive set of rules, the effect is to create a tranquil oasis in time and space, from which the future can be effectively contemplated. For 25 hours each week, Jews are required to put aside all work-related objects and activities. They are to abstain from activating any form of technological machinery, such as cars, televisions, computers, and phones. In fact, all devices that assist Jews in reaching out of themselves into the outer world and impacting it are off-limits. By restricting themselves from the usual acts of creativity and impacting the world, Jews are restraining themselves from being the subjects of creation, those who do the acts. Instead, they become objects, those upon whom the world works its magic. They are prohibited from imposing their creative drives on their environment because, by not doing so, they are better placed to observe what the environment has to offer them. This slice of time, 1/7 of each week, becomes not only a tremendous luxury, but also an indispensable aid to creative thinking during the rest of the week. It is a regular weekly period of time, during which their beings are set on receive mode, rather than transmit mode. Whatever time you determine to set aside for stoking up your creativity and enhancing your future vision should be governed by three rules. 1. It is far more important that it be a regular time than it be a lengthy period of time. In other words, rather make this time short but regular than long but random. Set aside an hour every Monday and every Thursday, or perhaps one morning every 2 weeks. Block it out in your calendar as if it were an appointment with your doctor or lawyer. 2. You should be doing nothing else at the same time. You should not be exercising, nor listening to music, and not eating a snack. In this way, you place yourself in receive mode. 3. You should alternate between keeping your mind quite clear and focusing your thoughts on the specific agenda you had earlier prepared. This will help prevent undisciplined mental meandering. Suppose, for example, that you are trying to determine the future significance of a new fact or of a set of numbers that have just come into your possession. Relax and try to put yourself into a receptive mode. Feel the sun warming your arms. Perhaps you hear the buzzing of a nearby bee or the rustling of some leaves in the tree overhead. Don't think. Just look, smell, see, and feel. Then jerk yourself into thought mode and reflect on the facts or figures that you suspect contain a germ of an idea for you. Wind the facts and figures around your mind. Wrap your consciousness about the data and try to visualize seeing it from every direction, from above and from below, and even from within the data themselves. When your brain shrieks for a break, get back into thoughtless receptive mode and just feel and absorb. Repeat the cycle several times. Don't be discouraged if you do not emerge from this Sabbath session without a breakthrough. That may come a few hours later, or even a day or two later. Many people are often inspired while in the shower. The reason for this is that taking a shower is almost like doing nothing, because for most people it has become an almost mindless, automatic activity. They wash all the same parts in the same sequence in the same way. Meanwhile, the white noise of rushing water effectively blocks out all other sounds and distractions. No wonder, then, that people are most sensitive to small, silent, little thoughts that creep into their consciousness while taking a shower. Creating a virtual shower by regular Sabbath sessions is one way of enhancing your ability to see the future for your financial benefit. How to derive the most benefit from your quiet forecasting time. One more caution is in order. This may be hard to swallow, but I recommend that for a period of at least 24 hours, and preferably double that, before you embark on your regular Absorb the Sounds of the Future sessions, you abstain from entertainment in the form of either movies or television programs. I realize that the usage of television is so ubiquitous that it is hard to imagine doing without it for any period of time. But watching television tends to make one lethargic, non-communicative, inactive, and sleepy. And the effects of almost any activity linger. If one eats some disagreeable food or ingests some toxic substance, it can take quite a while for the body to become completely free of the deleterious effects. The problem is that screen images are so seductive that it is almost impossible to escape their impact for some considerable period of time after exposure. The powerful pictures send emotional shockwaves ricocheting around your brain. As the result of an hour or two in front of either a large or a small screen, you become desensitized to the delicate. What is more, you are rendered more passive by the nature of this form of entertainment. Lloyd Billingsley pointed out that the very word amuse conveys a clue. The word muse means to think or ponder. The A in front of a word implies the opposite of the root word, just as it does in words like atheist, the opposite of a theist. In other words, Amusement is used to prevent thought or deep pondering. There are three main reasons that explain why amusing yourself through the medium of either television or cinema is damaging to your ability to foretell the future. Reason one. Light shining into your eyes possesses a mesmerizing quality. One recalls the phrase, "She stood immobilized, just like a deer caught in the headlights of a car." When you view a real-life scene, your eyes are converting into neural impulses the light they received by reflection from the scene. You do not look into the sun, the source of the light. Instead, the sunlight shines onto the scene, illuminating it, and the light is then reflected from the scene into your eyes. When watching television, however, the cathode ray gun, powered by about 25,000 volts of electricity, is aimed right at your face. It is beaming electrons directly toward your eyes. These strike the phosphor-coated glass screen located between the cathode ray gun and your eyes, and in turn, this screen emits the light that strikes your eyes. The light from images seen this way is propelled directly at your eyes in a way not found in nature. In fact, people are wisely cautioned as children never to look directly into a light. The images seen in this way tend to be powerfully implanted in memory and tend to affect thoughts more than they would have had they been absorbed, say, by reflected light. In contrast, reading about ideas or things grants you the most freedom to absorb or to reject. Pictures impact your emotions in a way that can cause temporary emotional imbalance. For this reason, shopping networks use television, but never radio. By dangling a glittering necklace before your eyes, the marketer stands a better chance of getting you to pick up the phone and place an order than if she had merely described it on the radio. Direct mail catalogs tend to be heavy on brightly colored pictures rather than on descriptive text. Thus, when you need all your faculties of discernment working at maximum efficiency, you certainly do not need powerful images thrust into your brain and overwhelming your subtle thought processes. Reason two. Television images are very fast-moving. The average television scene lasts no more than 25 seconds. This rapid-fire delivery of images accustoms your mind to immediate gratification. In reality, your most constructive thought processes do not work that quickly, and seeing the future requires you to patiently absorb the information at more real-life speeds. In a sense, television tends to produce in you an impatience quite antithetical to picking up and analyzing future trends. Here, the far slower process of assimilating data by reading works to your great advantage. Reason three. Television dulls your imaginative powers, whereas reading or listening to the spoken word develops these vital powers. Imagination is a crucial faculty in the process of trying to foresee the future. The methodology is quite simple. You start off by carefully examining the past and fully comprehending both the internal as well as the external factors that have brought you to the present. You then contemplate the current conditions along with the resources you are able to bring to bear. Finally, you allow your imagination free rein to come up with a variety of scenarios for the future. Some of these you will wisely reject out of hand. Among those remaining, you will find some that amaze you and some that terrify you. Some will attract you, whereas others will repel you. The key is to ensure a healthy imagination in order to summon up a range of possibilities for you to consider. Reading an account of some event, or hearing it retold, exercises your imagination. That is why watching a movie made of a book that you have read usually disappoints. At the very least, you recognize the movie to be quite different from what you had imagined from reading the book. Reading that book stimulated you to fill in the blanks. You develop a notion of what the characters look like and what the setting is. Later, while watching the picture, you note how very different it is. That picture up there on the screen deprives you of the freedom to create within your mind. Goal setting is seeing the future. As a motorcycle enthusiast, I once had the privilege of experiencing a few days of training at the hands of one of the experts who trains motorcycle officers for the California Highway Patrol. Although I had been riding for a long time, and in fact had ridden my old motorcycle across much of Africa many years ago, I was a self-taught rider. The very first day of real training I experienced drove home to me just how little I really knew. I was struck by how close to a miracle it was that I had survived my earlier two-wheeled adventures while so ignorant of basic riding techniques. I was also struck by how closely many aspects of motorcycling resembled running one's business life. For instance, under certain circumstances, one countersteers by momentarily turning the handlebars away from the direction in which one really wishes to travel. Likewise, in business, it is frequently necessary to temporarily steer away from one's objective, precisely in order to reach it in the quickest way possible. Even more useful is the lesson in riding safely through a long, sweeping curve on a motorcycle. Contrary to my earlier self-taught practice, I learned how much more effective it is if one twists one's head enough to keep the end of the turn in one's field of vision. I can still hear that instructor yelling the directive that has since saved my hide more than once. No, don't look where you are going. Look where you want to go. With great insight, he further explained that your body will subconsciously try to take the bike where you are looking. Knowing that, one may as well benefit from it by looking clearly at the goal. Watch tightrope artists at the circus. They know the same lesson. They do not look down at the rope. Instead, they fix their focus clearly on the little platform that marks the end of the perilous traverse. In your business life, although the same principle still applies, it is a little more complex because the goal is usually not in sight. That is where the ability to see the future becomes quite crucial. The constantly recurring biblical injunction to fear the Lord your God is a reminder of how important it is to be able to see the invisible. Because the Hebrew verb used for the phrase fear the Lord is actually the Hebrew word for seeing. In other words, the Bible is informing its devotees that if you can bring yourself to actually see God, then you will automatically come also to fear Him. Most people will never fear what they cannot see. For example, during the early years of the 20th century, it was close to impossible to persuade people of the peril of radioactivity. As a matter of fact, many sought out dubious cures by spending extended periods in radium mines. Years later, these patients developed horrifying symptoms of radioactivity burns. But at the time, they were reluctant to believe they could be harmed by something invisible. Whether you intend it in a religious context with an uppercase F, or in a business context with a lowercase F, The definition of possessing faith is having the ability to see the yet invisible as clearly as if it were present in material form, right before your eyes. Whether you are contemplating an investment or planning on opening a new business, faith is paramount. If you are unable to clearly visualize what it will all look like were it to go well, you would be better off deferring the action until you can see it. If you are about to pick up the phone to make a sales call or to propose a transaction, the ability to see the future is necessary. Your chances of success are vastly enhanced if you spend a few moments first actively visualizing the conversation with your prospect culminating triumphantly. Here is why I'm asking you to expend the energy necessary to force your brain to think positive thoughts. As the decoding of the Human Genome Project progressed, few of the many attendant discoveries thrilled me as much as this one did. According to psychologist David Moore of Pitzer College in Claremont, California, thoughts can cause the release of hormones that can bind to DNA, turning genes on or off. The difference between human brains and chimpanzee brains is not which genes each brain has, but which genes are turned on and which are switched off. Apparently, the discovery sprang from a science researcher who had to spend periods of several weeks at a time on a remote island in comparative isolation. He noticed that a day or two before his scheduled return to civilization and his family, his beard grew noticeably. The scientist was puzzled. He shared the information with his colleagues, all of whom knew that sexual activity releases a flood of testosterone. This hormone affects beards the way that a bag of grass food affects your front lawn. The astonishing aspect of this story is that the researchers realized that not only does the aforementioned activity stimulate beard growth, but merely anticipating female companionship also did the trick. Imagine that. Your thoughts can tweak your genetic expression. By spending a little preparation time actively anticipating a successful outcome to your efforts, by dwelling on that outcome, and by savoring the success with a smile on your face, you will actually be impacting your body and mind. You will be preparing yourself to bring about the success you crave. Suppose, for example, that you are about to enter a meeting during which you hope to persuade another party or parties of something. It could be anything. First, spend a few moments using your imagination to clearly visualize the ideal conclusion. Are you about to deliver a speech to your Rotary Club or to a large group of Wall Street analysts? First, take some quiet private time just prior to the event, during which you clearly visualize a triumphant presentation. Include the smallest details. Imagine the audience applauding. Remember my motorcycle instructor's warning that one tends to go where one is looking. Seeing the desirable outcome is one of the most useful aspects of developing an ability to see the future. Accustom yourself to analyzing today's events in the light of yesterday's history for the purpose of making necessary changes for tomorrow. As you read the newspaper or watch the news, always ask yourself, what is the underlying principle? If the news describes fanfare surrounding the invention of an improbable urban scooter that will completely revolutionize city planning, as happened in late 2001, think of the basic human need that is being catered to. During one of your quiet contemplation sessions, you will come to see that it is the desire of people to overcome the frustrating human limitations of time and space. Nobody can occupy two separate spaces simultaneously, is how science might express it. People have always distinguished themselves from vegetables and from animals by the desire to travel, and to travel quickly, thereby coming as close as possible to overcoming the frustrating limitations of not being able to be in two places at once. This principle would have enabled people to predict the gradual replacing of luxurious ocean liners by fast and uncomfortable jetliners. The human desire to not be restricted in any way at all is a spiritual desire and is thus found in the Torah. In the same way that the Torah has always been seen by Jews to contain a blueprint of reality in the realm of morality, it has also been seen to contain a blueprint of reality in the realms of ultimate physics, and of course, in ultimate economics. As I have shown, some things change during human history, whereas others hardly change at all. For example, whether humans make war with bows and arrows or with tactical nuclear devices, the one unchangeable is that humans make war, and the Torah discusses war as an ultimate reality. Whether humans travel by camel, canoe, Cadillac, or the Concorde supersonic airliner, the one unchangeable is that humans have a deep desire to be able to travel, and the Torah discusses the ultimate principles of travel. When a young Fairchild semiconductor scientist named Gordon Moore formulated what has come to be known as Moore's Law in 1965, he quickly came to be seen as a prophet. He predicted that the power and the complexity of the silicon chip would double every 18 months. When you double something 20 times every 1.5 years for 30 years, it increases by a factor of more than 1 million to 1. By 1995, Moore's Law was still going strong. The 1995 4 megabit chip was 4 million times more powerful than its predecessor, the transistor. In 1968, Moore, along with another Fairchild alumnus, Robert Noyce, started Intel, which became a more than $20 billion company in less than 35 years. A prophet? No. Gordon Moore learned to read the future in his field. The only son of poor Russian-Jewish immigrants, Al Lerner grew up living behind his parents' candy store in Queens, New York. He served in the Marine Corps and then became a furniture salesman. But Al Lerner understood what money was. He eventually became the country's leading specialist in Affinity credit cards through his finance company, MBNA. Since its founding in 1982, MBNA's strategy has been to sign up endorsing organizations who would help market Al's credit cards to their members in exchange for a small percentage of every transaction. Quite an odyssey. Child of candy store owners to furniture salesman to billionaire credit card banker. Only someone with a deep and almost intuitive sense of what money really is could do it. Al Lerner possessed that insight. Whether humans interact with one another through bits of gold, or with credit card transactions communicated through bits of electronic data, the one unchangeable is that money has always served as a means of human interaction. Knowing exactly what money is, how it comes into being, and how it vanishes grants one a wisdom that can easily be confused with prophecy. The next chapter looks at money. Your path to prosperity. Recognize which external events will affect your business or your life, and which will have no effect at all. Some coming events can cause real change that will impact your business, yet leave other kinds of businesses immune, whereas other future events will not affect your activities, but might well disrupt those of someone else. Never procrastinate in the face of the former, but refuse to be stampeded by the latter. Interpret events without emotion. Seeing the future has little to do with native skills or intelligence. Some highly educated individuals are conspicuously unsuccessful at predicting the future. Ego is one enemy of effective futurism. Learn to overcome it, and you are well on the way to seeing the future far more clearly. Before looking forward, look backward. If things are stable and steady, they will continue to be stable and steady unless acted on by some force. How likely is it for some force to materialize? If things are changing rapidly, they are already being acted on by some force. Find it, recognize it, and determine how that force is likely to behave. Will it continue? Will it strengthen or weaken? Examine the trend of the matter concerning you. What has it been doing up to the present? Once you have discovered the trend, you must ask yourself whether it has been behaving in this way because nothing has made it behave differently. Or is it behaving this way only because something is preventing it from behaving differently? Watch for patterns. There are always large patterns and trends to watch and to try to understand. As business professionals, you should remain on high alert for these trends, and you should try to understand the underlying causes driving them. Be open to the possibility of cycles and trends, but never allow yourself to become blinded by them. Cycles and trends should be a factor in your assessments of what the future will bring, but only one factor. And they should be given appropriate weight, neither too low nor too high. To hear the soft footsteps of approaching trends, block out all the external noise. Set aside time when other more compelling stimuli are absent. Only then will you be accessible to these tiny signals. Make sure you set aside a regular time, even if it is only a short amount of time. Do nothing else at the same time. In this way, you place yourself in what I call receive mode. Finally, alternate between keeping your mind quite clear and focusing your thoughts on the specific agenda you had earlier prepared. This will help prevent undisciplined mental meandering. Visualize your future. Whether you are contemplating an investment or planning on opening a new business, faith is paramount. If you are unable to clearly visualize what it will all look like were it to go well, you would be better off deferring the action until you can see it. Your chances of success are vastly enhanced if you spend a few moments first actively visualizing the conversation with your prospect as culminating triumphantly. Practice memorizing. To the extent that seeing the future is the flip side of remembering the past, our ability to recall becomes even more valuable. Although you probably haven't done this since elementary school, you should recover your ability to memorize. The best way to achieve this is by selecting poetry or prose you enjoy. Then set yourself a schedule to memorize something in its entirety. Select reading material that will help you recognize trends. There are magazines available, such as American Demographics, whose entire content is devoted to demographic trends. There are volumes published by the U.S. government, such as the Statistical Abstract of the United States. Initially, you will find much of this material unappealing and alien. Don't feel you must read these books and magazines cover to cover. In each, you will find at least something of interest. As time goes by, you will become increasingly familiar with the technology of analyzing trends, and you will come to enjoy both your mastery of the field and your growing arsenal of facts. The Eighth Commandment. Know your money. Your money is a quantifiable analog for your life force, the aggregate of your time, skills, experience, persistence, and relationships. Fishing for salmon one summer in the spectacular Saanich Inlet of Vancouver Island, British Columbia, taught me a useful lesson. After hooking what appeared to be a magnificent large salmon, I began licking my lips in anticipation of a barbecued salmon dinner with my family that evening. My elderly guide interrupted my reverie by calmly saying, "You have lost him." Because I could feel the fish fighting my attempts to reel him in, I hastily assured my well-intentioned mentor that he was wrong. With a jerk of his head, the guide indicated a large eagle sitting atop a tree on the shoreline about 20 or 30 yards away. "He's seen your fish," was all he said, as the eagle lazily spread his wings to their 8-foot wingspan and launched himself into the air. Within under a minute, during which time I was frantically winding in my line, trying to outrace the eagle, the raptor effortlessly swooped down on my doomed salmon, and with a lightning strike of his talons, scooped up the fish, ripped it off my hook, and returned to his perch on the tree to enjoy his dinner. Perhaps I imagined the mocking look he gave me every few minutes. What did I learn? I absorbed a practical lesson, one that I had only known in theory up till that moment. I had always learned how important it was to have as much information as possible about your quarry. Now, I understood what that meant. I needed a guide not only to tell me exactly where in the vastness of the ocean to find salmon, and what sort of bait would attract a salmon, but also to tell me exactly who was my competition for that salmon. In other words, if I was serious about catching salmon, I needed to know all there was to know about them. During my 20 years as a congregational rabbi, I have counseled many single people who, in theory, wanted to be married, although they claimed not to know how to bring this about. The salmon experience helped me advise my friends. "To convince a particular woman to marry you," I explained to men, "it is not enough merely to desire her. You must also understand her. Perhaps she seeks assurance that in various areas, be they emotional, sexual, social, physical, or economic, you are capable of taking care of her and protecting her. If so, you need to beam her pictures, not only of who you are and who you have been, but also of who you could ultimately become with her help. Trying to really understand the woman is the only way to win her." To women, I said much the same thing. You have to understand as much as possible about men in general and the man in whom you are interested in particular. You need to know not only what he has to offer you, but also what he needs you to offer him. You should know what is going through his mind, even if his thoughts are wrong. That was just a start. There was much more I would tell single men and women seeking marriage, but you get the idea. If you are trying to attract and acquire something, you need to know as much as possible about that thing first. Trying to learn how to increase your income by studying those who have done so, instead of first understanding the true nature of money, would be a little like an aspiring actor studying Clint Eastwood instead of first studying the craft of acting. This eager thespian is not Clint Eastwood and will never be Clint Eastwood. His only hope of success on the stage lies in becoming himself. Similarly, you could study how Alan Ace Greenberg, who became the legendary head of the financial firm Bear Stearns, started off as a $32.50-a-week clerk before he pestered the head of the risk arbitrage department into giving him a position with responsibility.